roughly, is the cost of the mortgage interest deduction, the property tax deduction, and the exclusion of capital gains on the sale of a home. So just in rough terms, one out of every $5 is spent from the federal level where the greatest need is, and four out of $5 goes to people like Steve Novick, who frankly, if you pushed him, would say it's nice to have, but it's not the difference between he and his bride having a roof over their head. So not that I want to take it away from him, and I see you're proposing potentially some restrictions on second homes. And I think at some point, you know, those are good discussions about is the program too generous. But of the $190 billion, 40 goes to folks that are desperately in need of our help right now. And there's really not, because it's not part of the federal discussion, we don't have any great hope that that's going to change in the short term. And just imagine if we had the political will to double that number, what it would mean locally, Mayor, in terms of the programs that we're supporting. It would be a game changer.
All more reason to watch this. Appreciate the partnership that the Alliance has with us and chance to really get some important work done next session. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Holland, come on up, please. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Likewise. Good morning.
Good morning.
Council members. Katrina Holland, interim director at the Community Alliance of Tenants, and as you've heard, I'm here to talk today about the impacts that we've seen, both current and potential, and also talk to you about some of the things that CAT is doing, both on a local and statewide level, to address the housing crisis and how we'd like to partner with you moving forward. And as you requested, Commissioner Novick, I will give a brief response to the proposals presented by Director Krager, although some of the stuff I'm just now seeing, so it'll be really interesting. I say all that to say I have some response now, and then I will have some response later for you and Commissioner Saltzman. So in a nutshell, in terms of current impact, I think we've heard the numbers. About 48% of Portland's population are renters, and about half of them are rent burdened. And as a result of that, as you've heard, we have people choosing between food, health care, caring for their children, potentially saving for socioeconomic advancement opportunities with housing. It's competing with housing as a result of increasing rents. In addition to that, we have people who are living in substandard housing conditions simply because they are afraid of wanting to report their repair issues that need to be. What's happening here? Okay. What's happening? So we're also hearing that folks are afraid to report repairs that are needed to their landlord because they're afraid that they're going to get a no-cause eviction, or they're afraid they're going to get a rent increase, or there's going to be some sort of excuse given by the landlord to say, well, the repairs are so drastic that we need you to leave. And so, you know, we've heard that time and time and time again, but I also want to just kind of drill down into some of the impacts that that has. You know, we're seeing a great example is a young woman by the name of Cynthia, you probably saw on the news, 15-year-old young lady who recently received a 90-day notice eviction. Her family was part of a building-wide eviction that happened over in the west part of the region, and she basically said, I can't focus on school because I'm worried about whether I'm going to be homeless or not in 90 days. And to Community Alliance of Tenants, and I think to all of us as a city, that is very deeply concerning to think that a young child who has the whole world ahead of them is afraid or is not able to focus on building their future because they're afraid of where they're going to live. In thinking about that on the long term, What does that say about our employment pool moving forward? What does that say about our economic future moving forward, both as a city and as a state? So that's the case that we're making to the legislature. In addition, we've heard stories of people who are unable to receive medical care as a result of housing instability. There was a couple of stories, actually, that we heard on our hotline where someone was in the midst of trying to get a life-saving surgery, and the doctor said that they were not able to do that because they were in the midst of a no-cause eviction and had a few months in order to get out, and the doctor was afraid that that person would not have a place to recover. We have not heard from that person. We're hoping that they're okay, but that is just a glimpse of the kinds of decisions that some people have to make. I also remember personally talking to a senior who frankly said, I'm taking half of my prescribed medication because my rent has increased 40%. More recently, we heard of a 350% increase that happened in the west part of the region. I believe the family was paying $1,500, and now they're paying somewhere between $45,000 and $5,000. And that happened within a matter of days. I think it was 30 to 60 days. And that family had been there for several years. More recently, in the city of Tigard, the building-wide eviction that I was just telling you about, their eviction date is in the end of October. And that those particular tenants are predominantly communities of color, and a lot of them don't know where they're going to go. And so as a result, Community Alliance of Tenants has been working with them to try to negotiate with the landlord a longer stay. And we received a response from the landlord. Landlord said no. And so that's just giving you a picture of the impact that we're seeing among tenants. And that's just a glimpse, right? Because Community Alliance of Tenants doesn't necessarily serve the entire city of Portland, though we'd like to, and we're trying to expand. We're also hearing reports, as Allison has told you, in Eugene, in Bend, in Medford, in Hood River. Johnson was explaining that there were four teachers living in their vans, even though they were they were employed. And so this crisis is reaching levels that we think is completely unacceptable, that we know is unacceptable. And I think it is incumbent upon us as a city to do something about it immediately, both to repeal the ban on rent stabilization, to enact just cause eviction protections as soon as possible, begin crafting those policy options soon, so that hopefully when we are given the okay from the state, we can enact those policies, but also to act within our current purview. I think to your question, Commissioner Novick, I think it is a very good idea to start thinking about landlord registration and begin crafting what that policy would look like and those different processes and procedures, because we do need to have an adequate picture of what we're looking at. I think, you know, as I've sat in these meetings and in city council and in legislative meetings, one of the main questions that everybody has is how difficult is it? How many units do we have? How many no-cause evictions are we seeing? What are the rent increases? And the fact that we don't have that data to make those decisions is really, really distressing, particularly the Community Alliance of Tenants. I would also say that we do support, in essence, the Keep Portland House campaign by Portland Tenants United asking for a rent freeze. As I've explained to you, Commissioner Saltzman, Community Alliance of Tenants is very interested in the city enacting a rent freeze if the ban is repealed. Because I think, as we saw previously in enacting the 90-day notice ordinances for no-cause eviction protections, there was some retaliatory no-cause evictions and rent increases that went into place as landlords were afraid. And so what we don't want that to happen again, because that could be drastic. And I would also say that we absolutely have to think about due process. This is the first time that I've heard about restraining orders being put on tenants to get around the 90-day notice provision. So I think due process is also something we definitely need to consider. At the Oregon Housing Alliance table, where CAT is leading the tenant protections work group, there are some discussions about what local enforcement would look like, whether that's a housing court or ombudsman's office at a statewide level. I think, you know, it's for us to decide as we move forward, both as a state and local jurisdictions. But I do think that is also something we need to consider, as local enforcement options if the ban is repealed, because obviously it's going to be very difficult for the state administratively to enforce these laws. I would also say that you know, we are leading the coalition called the Secure Homes for Oregon Families, which is a coalition of diverse stakeholders. We have labor unions, housing advocates, health advocates, the Fair Shot Coalition, Oregon Opportunity Network, and the Oregon Housing Alliance, all working on a statewide legislative agenda to push just cause and rent stabilization, among other items. And I think that, you know, as we move forward, we need to begin to think about how we're going to enact these policies. I would also like to echo, now granted, I'm fairly young and new to this, but I would also like to echo what Martha Pellegrino was saying, in that the what we noticed in legislative days, because I met with several legislators through the Fair Shot Coalition and individually, I will say that there is an appetite for local jurisdictions to enact policies that work for them that I also haven't heard of before. And so to your comment, Commissioner Fish, about potential sideboards, I think that's always a risk when we're thinking about statewide policy, but I'm not so sure that that may be an issue. Of course, it's too early to tell, but it is something that we'll definitely work hard on. So with that being said, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Katrina, I wanted to ask you the same question I asked Director Krieger, which is, are just cause protections useless in the absence of rent stabilization, which I've heard some people say? Now, let's just suppose for the moment that the legislature repeals the prohibition against just cause statutes, but does not repeal the prohibition against rent stabilization. Would it still be meaningful to require just cause, or would it be really a paper tiger, a meaningless gesture?
That's a very good question, and I think the answer to your question is it would absolutely be meaningful. Will it be as meaningful as it could be? Probably not. But I do think that not having just cause protections enacted on a local level would continue to be devastating as this market continues to trend upward. So, I mean, at the end of the day, the stories that we're hearing is that landlords a new company comes in and purchases a building or purchases a house, and they recognize an opportunity to raise the level of, or to raise rents because the market is doing it, AKA everybody else is doing it. And so they kick them out and raise the rents. And having just cause eviction protections can prevent that instance. Now, does it mean that they could just raise the rents? It does. And that's part of the reason why we are fighting as hard as we are to enact or to repeal the ban on rent stabilization this session. It's a very hard fight, but we're trying as hard as we can.
By the way, I was struck by Director Krieger's comment that state legislators are often honeycombed with landlords, mm-hmm. Because in states that do not pay legislators a living wage, you tend to attract people of independent sources of income, and
yes.
Property is often an independent source of income. So it occurs to me that maybe part of our agenda should also be paying legislators a living wage.
I would have to agree with that. I will say, you know, it's if I'm just frank, it is very difficult, you know, working in this arena and talking with legislators, because a lot of the things that we talk about and the stories that we describe, automatically legislators tend to personalize it. Oh, well, I would never do something like that, so why would anyone else? And so that particular barrier is just really difficult, but we're going to try.
Let me put something into the mix here, actually, that I hope both you and the Alliance will take into account. A little bit of a long preamble, but stick with me. One of the things that the Obama administration did that was really constructive, and that actually I urged the president to try to figure out a way to make it cultural in those agencies to survive the transition, is he got HUD, EPA, and USDOT to actually think together, and they called it the Livable Communities Initiative. And so let's see, if we're going to spend $1 billion on a transit line, maybe that's where the affordable housing ought to go. Mm-hmm. And so they actually started doing this. I mean, actually, those three agencies actually started working in concert better mm-hmm. than I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And the people in those agencies got excited about this, and it got right down to the granular level of having HUD and EPA staff helping Federal Transit Administration staff decide which projects to fund. So, yes, good stuff.
Good stuff, yeah.
So I'll get back to that, because I think there may be an opportunity for that locally and regionally. I really appreciate the fact that you and the Alliance are both pushing us as a city to do everything we can do, but are also thinking regionally. You mentioned examples from elsewhere in the metropolitan area and statewide. Because I think one of the fears or concerns about this issue is that Portland will do the right thing and maybe the rest of the region won't. And mm-hmm. so we'll just continue to bear the burden as best we can, but end up receiving more of the refugees from a housing market that doesn't serve them.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to get back to something here. Thinking back to what they did at the federal level, there's this thing called the Metropolitan Housing Rule that people have forgotten about, but that I used to work on when I worked at the Home Builders Association, that says the suburbs have to zone themselves for both single and multifamily housing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's still in force. And there's a percentage. So it was a blunt instrument, but it was intended to avoid having prosperous suburbs that just zone themselves for single-family lots and have all the multifamily housing in the city. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we need to return to the metropolitan housing rule and say, how do we connect that to an affordability agenda? In other words, let's see, as we're handing out regional transportation funds, which Metro does through JPAC, maybe you don't get those unless you also have rent stabilization. Mm-hmm. So I want to just plant that seed that this dusty old thing called the Metropolitan Housing Rule did actually have some effect, and there were places like Happy Valley that fought it bitterly because they didn't want a zone for multifamily, and they were forced to. And when I worked at the Home Builders Association, we actually sued local governments that weren't doing their share of zoning for multifamily. Didn't guarantee that it would be affordable, but at least you could build apartments there. Yeah. So I guess I'm saying on that old foundation of the Metropolitan Housing Rule, it might be possible to build something that addresses affordability, not just provision of zoning. Mm. So just want to plant those seeds. I don't think Metro is thinking about that yet, about how do we make sure that those who get transportation dollars are not just helping people drive from expensive houses at the urban growth boundary to jobs in the city center.
Yeah.
But see where I'm headed here. So. Yeah. Again, I think that would be a radical thing to do for Metro to say, you don't get transportation money unless you're doing your share in housing, but the federal government under the Obama administration did it. So I think their good example might teach us something.
I think so.
So we can have some fun with that.
Yeah, we will. I did want to mention a couple other things. Before I head out, I do want to make sure that we stress the importance of acting now as opposed to waiting for the market to cool off or waiting for affordable housing units to come online, because Community Alliance of Tenants, as you have heard, has seen and heard and felt and will continue to feel this impact as devastating as it is. And as the data suggests that Director Krieger put forward, there's some real collateral damage that we could be looking at. People are living on the streets. People are dying in the streets as a result of no-cause evictions and a lack of rent stabilization. That's the reality. And I know it's very difficult to swallow that, but I would just like to push very hard to say, as we move forward, let's not wait for markets to come online and let's not wait for the market to cool down. We do need to act as quickly as possible. I also wanted to point out that because of the significant impact that we've seen, as you know, Community Alliance of Tenants focuses a lot of its work on vulnerable populations, low-income seniors, people with disabilities, communities of color, and they are disparately and disproportionately impacted. We've done a little bit of research to find out whether this is a fair housing issue, and it has come back that it could potentially be. And so I think that's also something we need to consider as a city. In terms of making decisions to address this crisis, and also as a state to address this crisis, because we could essentially be violating fair housing law, and that's extremely important. So on that note, that's it. Thank you.
Other thoughts, follow-up actions? You're on with.
I'm ready. Well, I wanted just to remind everybody about the Afghan Health Safety Properties Program that is entirely within our power to bring back. It was cut in the last budget because the police didn't have enough staff to partner with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement and BDS, and then we cut the crime prevention position that was working on that thing, on that program. So as we're looking at what could we do, there's something that's absolutely within our power to do, which is to bring that back. And then my next question is, oh, did you have a comment on that? Are we allowed to do things like requiring refund of the security deposit 2 months? As soon as they get the eviction notice, can we say, have the units inspected to see that it was in the same shape that it came in, and that the landlords would be required then to refund the security deposit and maybe give free second to last month rent, because you have to pay first and last and security deposit to get to another apartment. And when I was talking to a landlord about this concept, he thought he was just outraged. She said, well, it's the industry standard. And yes, that's the problem. Yeah. When people are evicted, I mean, and maybe that comes with the just cause eviction, but potentially could the city do that because it's not rent control?
Action. So December 6th, of course, is one of the next gates in this slalom that we're going to be trying to develop our legislative package then. Obviously, quite a bit of work underway at the Alliance in between now and then. I guess, Kurt, this question and others about what else within your construct here, we have the opportunity to do legislatively now on our own. I think we're all very interested in that.
And I just wanted to add, just having attended the League of Oregon Cities board meeting yesterday, we got a similar preview about the session days they had last week. But clearly, and this was true with inclusionary zoning as well, to the extent that we are talking about removing preemptions on local governments, that's something that generally resonates well with all 242 cities in the state of Oregon. So I think that's really going to be the tone that we're going to have to take, and the allies that we can count on is as long as we're talking about giving local governments. And I can't remember whether it was Allison or Katrina or whatever that said local governments are sort of, or maybe it was Martha, that local governments are increasingly looked to as a source of innovation and problem solving. And maybe the state's exhausted about trying to deal with these issues. Maybe they could just lift the preemptions and allow us to... to work under the theory that we are closest to the residents of the jurisdictions we're elected to represent. So I think that's going to be a good theme for us to continue to drive home is, giving local governments more control.
Steve, I have a question off of the outline you gave us under closing remarks. It says other options, legal aid. Now, we know that something like one out of five eligible people is getting access to legal aid. And we know that it's the work of legal aid lawyers is critical in this area. What's the option under consideration there? Is it simply a budget ask?
Actually, Commissioner, I don't know. I don't know. Commissioner Saltzman, do you know what that reference was intended to address?
I'm not sure either, but I would... Katrina Holland mentioned housing courts, and that was something I was interested in when she mentioned that to me the other day. And I certainly think if you're going to have a housing court, you need to be able to make sure that the tenants have legal representation. And so that could be what it's alluding to, but I'm not sure how that bullet made it there itself.
Well, so I'll just underscore. It appears to be on a list of things that the Bureau is going to report back on. So I'd be interested in knowing what options do we have to help support the work of legal aid that, again, they do great work, but I think the last statistic they put out is they're only able to serve about one out of five eligible clients. And so to what extent can we help them get to a broader pool? So if that's on the list, I applaud it. Love to know more.
Follow-up that I wanted to mention is that I'm not sure when this would be appropriate, but I think it would be useful to have a discussion about rent stabilization as the Housing Alliance conducts further research, and perhaps we could ask Allison and the Housing Bureau to come back to us at some point in the next few months and hear a presentation on best and worst practices.
Under the first bullet of analyzing and reporting back, I'd like to see the community groups included in that in those discussions, the PHACs, CAT, Port and Talents United, and because we're going to be bringing the Office of Neighborhood Involvement's plan for the outreach on housing and homelessness, I would expect that there will be some people who will show up to those meetings thinking that they can affect policy, which they can't, because that's not what it's for. But it would be nice to know what the process is for developing these recommendations so that the public engages, and particularly with CAT and PTU, that are some of the experts on it. And then I would like to know what you can do as a timeline for getting the information requested in the budget note as far as funding these things because the mandatory licensing, the registration of landlords and mandatory inspections would be done presumably through BDF. So I think it's something that's within our power to do. We shouldn't wait, as was pointed out, we shouldn't wait until the legislature is convening to do some of the things that we're allowed to do.
Right, particularly if it helps put pressure on them to do it beyond our city limits. Good points. All right, so we'll hear back.
I'll make sure that Director Krieger and Director Scarlett get something to us on that.
Thank you.
By the way, I'm speaking of Portland Tenants United. I wanted to acknowledge Jamie Duhamel from PTU, who's here today. We appreciate their continued engagement.
Well, thank you all. Oh, good. All right. Well, come spend a minute if you want.
I would love to.
Yeah, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity. Portland Tenants United is a growing tenants unit, and as you probably know, we count our constituents as the 300,000 renters in the Portland metro area, but we have about 1,000 active members, and about 60 of those are people like me who spend every day of our lives living and breathing this issue as volunteers, because we're all renters, right? And we're facing this head on every single day. And I have 5 kids, so you can imagine how I'm desperately clinging to my current housing situation. So we really appreciate the long-term legislative look that these organizations are really working hard on. We're part of the Housing Alliance. We are working together very diligently with them to really make sure that change happens at a state level. It's really, really essential. However, as renters in Portland, we're really focusing on what the city can do now. And at this point in time, we have met with nearly all of your offices and have provided you with a very comprehensive Tenants Bill of Rights, which includes policy solutions. The 3 tenets of that Bill of Rights includes the right to rent, which the policy there is address our ability to change the discriminatory screening practices that keep tenants from even getting into homes to begin with. The right to recourse, which means we've talked about that a lot, a need for tenants to be able to address issues in their home, access either legal aid or some kind of form of mediation. Those policy solutions are in that Tenants Bill of Rights as well. The third I'd like to focus on, though, because it answers some of your questions, and that's the right to remain, and that's where our Just Cause eviction policy solutions are put in place. Portland Tenants United believes very strongly that we can enact a rent freeze and a moratorium on no-cause evictions now based on a very solid legal brief put together by a longtime, well-known, respected lawyer, Stephen Goldberg. Each of your offices also has that. So that's something that we can do now. But in our Just Cause eviction policy solutions, one of the things that we suggest is that what is not preempted by state law are relocation assistance. These policies were constructed based on what other cities are doing in other areas of cities comparable to ours. And our suggestion is what Portland can do immediately is say, fine, you can evict anybody for no reason whatsoever. We cannot change the no-cause situation. It's a long-term solution that needs to be addressed at the state. However, if you're going to do that, it's going to be extremely inconvenient and fairly expensive for you to do. And the whole idea is that we give landlords pause to think about the displacement that they're about to achieve and about the really the seriousness of pushing people out of their homes for no reason whatsoever. Right now, the entire burden of being able to relocate is placed on the most vulnerable in that power dynamic, right? It's the tenant who doesn't have the money because 70-some percent of their income is already going into their monthly rent. They have no ability to save, no ability to plan for any of this. They can't make the kind of money that would allow them to do that. And so it's all going into the landlord's pockets. And so what does that look like? If they want to evict a tenant for no reason whatsoever and give them 90 days, well, within that 90 days, then they give up the rent that they would otherwise collect, and they immediately return their security deposit. We've done an intense amount of research around this, and it is not preempted. We've asked the Oregon Law Center. It is not preempted, and it is perfectly legal. That does have to couple, obviously, with immediate registration and mandatory recordings of evictions, because we have no data, and if we don't mandatorily, you know, ask for a mandatory recording, then we have no way to follow up and make sure that it's happening. So those are our policy solutions. You all have them in your office. We would love to have any kind of follow-up discussions about moving that forward, but our goal as PTU is to make these things happen now, regardless of what happens at the state, but we will continue to be allies with, you know, all of these legislative actions as well.
That's very helpful. Could you put your name in the record, please?
My name is Jamie Duhamel.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I appreciate what you're advocating. Thank you.
Steve, Dan, I just want to add my voice to thank you for organizing this work session. I think it was very informative, very helpful.
I want to thank Andrea Valderrama and my staff for helping to organize it, and Shannon Callahan of Dan's staff.
And Mayor, as a follow-up on all of our behalf, could you make sure that our city attorney looks over this brief from Mr. Goldberg?
I will. Yeah, let's do that. Good. Thank you all very much. Good work.
Do you mind my hand?